I'm Matthew Petty, and this is an encore presentation of Intersection. Carl Hyacin is a Florida-born journalist, columnist, and novelist. On the program, I'll speak to him about his latest book, Bad Monkey, and about how he finds inspiration for his writing in the landscape and politics of the Sunshine State. Also, University of Central Florida legal studies lecturer and president of the Central Florida Gay and Lesbian Law Association, Chad Cronin, discusses the impact of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on marriage equality in Florida. That's ahead on Intersection. Carl Hyacin started his career at the Miami Herald in 1976, working as a general assignment reporter, magazine writer, and investigative reporter. He continues to publish a column in the Herald, but he's more widely known for his novels, which offer up a rich blend of crime, politics, and comedy, and often with a serious theme of environmental awareness. His latest novel is called Bad Monkey. I spoke to Hyacin before a recent book signing in Orlando.
This book begins with a body part being fished out of the ocean. Have you ever been in that situation where you've fished something unusual out of the sea?
Not a severed arm, not like in the book, no. But I've certainly, you know, if you live in Florida long enough, there's a term, and without getting too, I mean, in the cop world, they're referred to as floaters, and it means it's a dead body in the water. We have a lot of water in Florida, and people do expire in the water. In this case, the book opens with a tourist couple, a man and a woman, who are on a charter boat out of Key West, and they're fishing. And as usual, the husband's kind of the macho character, and the rod bends, and he rushes over and snatches it to prove to, you know, show his wife what a big tough hombre he is. And he reels in this arm, and at the end of the arm is a hand, of course, and the hand has a digital manifestation that is a common, something you'd see on the highway a lot here if you cut somebody off.
Sure.
Or honked at the wrong person. And it sort of sets the mystery in motion. The couple, the woman is horrified, of course. And the guy, that's all he catches all day. So when she's posing with her fish at the end of the day, the husband's posing with the dead arm, because that's what we do.
Now, the character in this book, Bad Monkey, Andrew Yancey, he is a police officer is going through some troubles. He's kind of trying to get his old job back, essentially.
He's a detective, and he loses his job because he loses his temper in a situation involving a girlfriend who happens to be married to his dermatologist. It was probably a good romantic choice for him. But so there's a moment in a very public way. He goes kind of nuts, and so they have to really fire him. But at the same time, they know he's a good cop. So this happens in Key West, Florida, where there is a system. They take care of each other. They take care of everybody down there. And so his boss, the sheriff, says, look, you can't be a detective anymore, but I got you a job with the health department inspecting restaurants. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what in the vernacular is known as roach patrol. You're on the roach patrol. And it's a kind of a come down for a kind of a hotshot detective. But he's going to cope the best he can. And his dream is to solve a real murder case and get his job back.
Do you find that sometimes police officers do have something in common with journalists?
Well, I think, now I can't speak, I don't know for all police officers, but I've known enough, cops over the years and DEA agents and customs agents and at all levels that what often draws them to the job is a sense that they might be able to make a difference. You know, I mean, ideally when they're young, I think that's what pulls them in. And I think journalists the same way. You think that if you write about something and expose a set of facts or put the information out there that a wrong can be righted or something terrible can be prevented, and you dispense with that notion fairly early on. So I think what you have in common with sort of a seasoned detective and a seasoned journalist is a certain level of cynicism, but you still don't lose your heart and your hunger to make things right. It's just that you learn the hard way that there's a lot of battles you lose before you win one or two.
Mm-hmm. The monkey is also a key character in this book, and in this case, he's a failed actor, you could say.
Yeah, this is a monkey. I just got kind of tired of going to the movies, and watching TV shows where they have, like, and I call it the gratuitous monkey. And it's always a little capuchin monkey and who screeches and makes a funny face and darts off. But he's just there for sort of comic effect. And so I wanted a monkey with substance and depth, you know, mm-hmm. and a backstory. So this is, he is a very bad monkey. I'm not going to say that he isn't. But he does have a story arc that when you learn about him, you sort of can empathize it with his nasty nature. And he's wound up in the Bahamas through his acting career took an unfortunate turn because he was working on the Johnny Depp pirate movies. As you know, they had the little monkey character in that thing, and he was one of the stand-in monkeys, and he did something very naughty one day, and he got fired, and they wouldn't pay his plane ticket back to L.A. because they wouldn't even pay a real actor's plane ticket back to L.A., much less a monkey. So mm-hmm. he's sort of stranded in the Bahamas, and he ends up in the care of this gentleman named Neville, who is in a fight for his to save this little piece of property he has on this very small island that his whole family's had, and it's been bought up by an American developer, and he's trying to just cling to it. And he's got this monkey that he's adopted who he's trying to sort of rehabilitate, and it's not working out too well. But Yancey ends up over in the islands with them during a hurry. Yancey, in tracking this murder mystery, it takes him to these islands, and that's where he bumps into the bad monkey, mm-hmm. literally.
Do you think Florida has more than its fair share of monkey stories?
You know, I think, I remember after Hurricane Andrew, and I even wrote about this in a book called Stormy Weather, a novel called Stormy Weather. After Hurricane Andrew hit, a lot of the wildlife farms in South Dade County were demolished by the storm, and the people had fled, the humans had fled the scene, but all these animals were released, including many, many pythons, which we're now getting our fill of. But there was a facility that had a lot of rhesus monkeys that were being used for medical testing or for something. And they were all scattered. And the rumor was flying around Miami that these monkeys had been used were being used in HIV experiments. And you know, half of Miami was leveled, or half of Dade County. People were scared, and there's a lot of guns down there, and they were afraid. And so the police had given them permission to shoot any monkey they saw. You can imagine in Miami. And so these poor monkeys, the few that were bedraggled monkeys that were wandering around after the storm were becoming the nobody, I don't think, ever hit one, but I think they were shooting at everything that even looked like a monkey. So it was just craziness. And I saw one of them myself cross the road in front of me down there after the storm, and he looked like a haunted figure.
You've been writing these novels for some time now, and there seems to be a wealth of material in Florida. I mean, where do you get your inspiration from, and why is it that Florida seems such fertile ground for novelists?
Well, I don't know. You're writing humor, and you can have two reactions to what happens in Florida. You can take it seriously and get depressed, or you can sit back and laugh at it, which is what most Floridians do, because it is a crazy place. It's an incredibly fast-growing place, dynamic, but it's also a freak show. And if you're a writer, and I'm a journalist and a novelist, it's the best show going.
You've seen some changes, no doubt, from when you grew up mm-hmm. in Florida to what the state's become now. Not all of those changes have been good.
None of them have been good. If you can tell me one that's been good, I'd be interested. No, I mean, it's gone from a rural place to an very urbanized state, which is the price of sort of unbridled, unmanaged, and mismanaged growth. At the same time, there's been a tremendous influx of people who have fallen in love with what Florida really is, and not just the sort of iconic postcard image. And so I will say you have a much stronger environmental consciousness now than you did when I was a kid, and all the years, those boom years, we just sat and watched the concrete go up, and there was no sense of political activism because we just were watching our little paradise disappear. And now, thanks to a lot of the folks that moved here and sort of picked up the fight, that we have a very strong environmental voice. When I was a kid, no political candidate ever mentioned the Everglades in the context of a statewide political race. The supposition was that no one cared. It was just a big swamp. And now you can't run for state office, or even, you know, the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives, whatever it is, you have to come out in favor of the Everglades. It's become an apple pie issue in Florida, and that is progress. It's sad because it took many, many years and had a great loss of wetlands and habitat and great damage to our fresh water supply. But there is now a big constituency fighting for the Everglades. So that qualifies as progress.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm talking with South Florida author and journalist Carl Hyerson about his latest novel, Bad Monkey, which is set in the Florida Keys and the Bahamas. You can join the conversation online on our Facebook page or Twitter at WMFE Orlando. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Coming up, Hyerson talks about Florida as a source of inspiration for writers and how journalism has changed in the course of his career.
Carl, you started out as a reporter, mm-hmm. and you became a columnist for
For
the Miami Herald.
Yeah.
When you set out in the career of journalism, were you one of those people who thought, I am going to make a difference, I'm going to make a change? Did you have sort of high hopes of changing things in Florida?
Well, you have to remember that when I came out of school, the year that I left school was the Watergate had broken, and 4 months after I left school, Richard Nixon resigned after I left college. I mean, this was the age of Woodward and Bernstein. So, yeah, sure, I had some idealism. Mainly, I just wanted to write. And I knew, I'd known from a very young age I wanted to write. And I knew that there's no better place to learn, not only about writing fast and on deadline, but learn about life than a city newsroom. And many, many, many American novelists and British novelists as well come out of journalism backgrounds. And there's a reason for that. I mean, the material is great, but you also get to sit and write every day, which is what writers need to do. So that was my main thing going in. I mean, I always loved the newspaper business. I thought it would be exciting. I knew it would be something new every day. But mainly I wanted to learn how to exercise that muscle of writing and to be able to do it, you know, and get better and better at it.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that journalism grads now have the same kinds of opportunity as you did when you set out in journalism back when you started?
That's a good question, because the popular thinking now is that newspapers are dying off and that everybody's getting their news off the internet. Maybe, but people still have to go out and gather the news. And the fact is that you can get a lot of information off the internet, but it may not be good information. I mean, just because a blogger writes 700 words doesn't mean he knows anything about what he's writing. Whereas you still have the editing, the filtration of the editing and the oversight of working for a newspaper, where you not only have to be able to write, you have to be able to collect and present facts accurately, because you're in big trouble if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've moved into an age where information, good information, is more valuable and more necessary than it's ever been. So I'm encouraged by that. It may not be delivered on your doorstep the way it always has been. You know, you may be getting it off your computer, you may be getting it off your iPhone or your iPad, whatever it is, but there's still this tremendous thirst and hunger, and even if it manifests itself in this, you know, what happened to Lindsay Lohan yesterday and everybody's on their iPhone looking. But it could also be what was the vote on gun control in the Senate. Somebody's got to get out there. Still has to be sort of boots on the pavement getting that information. And so I think there are the possibilities. I think it's a tough job market. But I hear people say, why would he even go to journalism school now? But you know what? They said the same thing when I was in journalism school. And they said the same thing when I was graduating. Jobs are tough jobs. And this is in the golden age of the Washington Post and, mm-hmm. you know, all this stuff going on. And I think it's always, you got to work hard to get a job.
Do you like to read news online, or do you prefer the traditional?
I prefer the traditional way, but the truth is... I live a couple hours out of Miami, so I can't get my own newspaper delivered on my doorstep anymore. So I have to read the Miami Herald online. I do get the New York Times delivered and the local newspaper delivered. I liked, when I'm traveling, I love to pick up the Boston Globe or the Times or wherever I happen to be, the LA Times. I just like the feel of it. I like to be able to look at the whole page, the layout. Reading online is the information's all there, but you don't have the impact, and you don't have the ability to sort of scan and pick and choose as easily. You miss a lot of good stories if you're reading the paper just online. Mm-hmm. You miss that weird, odd feature story on page C13. And for a novelist, and I'm always trolling for material, I'd like to see that, because the little things I clip out sometimes, it'll turn up in a novel 5 years later, are the ones that are not going to get promoted online. They're not going to get featured online.
I mean, the population is one thing that's sort of changing in Florida, the demographics, the sheer number of people coming into the state. Do you get any sense that there's something positive that can come out of that?
No. I don't. I don't think anytime some place is stampeded, I don't see anything positive. It's just you're going to look at the crisis in the water situation right now. I mean, I think you have tremendous stress on the resources. I think you have the coastal pollution. I think you certainly have what the BP oil spill exemplified, tremendous risk to the oceans, the marine life as well, and the commercial fishery, which is put at risk. No, I don't think there's any. I mean, it's great if you're selling real estate, or if you're building houses, then more the merrier. But the long-term cost to the quality of life is dramatic. Mm-hmm. And there's nobody in the state that's going to tell you the quality of life today is better than it was 20 years ago. Yeah. Anybody sitting on I-4 right now, or I-95 in rush hour, unbelievable. I mean, really, it's every bit as bad as it is in the Northeast Corridor, every bit as bad as it is in L.A., if the idea is just to make as much money as you can by cramming as much humanity as possible into a certain amount of real estate, oh yeah, then it's great, the more the merrier. And that's Governor Scott's position. He can't see it. That guy can't get enough concrete.
Do you think there is some kind of a balance that can be struck between the tourism economy and the needs of the environment here in Florida?
Well, it's not really truly, even though I make fun of tourists a lot in the books and a little bit in Bad Monkey, too. I mean, I don't mind the tourists. It's the ones who stay that you got to worry about. They come and they go and they spend their money. We love the tourists, but the ones who stay, and they stay for the wrong reasons. I mean, there are a lot of folks that come here that really, truly love this place and see right away that it's special. And it's not just because we don't have a state income tax, but because it's got so much beauty and so much to offer, and it can be a great place to raise your kids. But there's a lot wrong here. There's a lot that needs fixing, and you got to get a handle on the problems before you keep inviting all these people in. I mean, the problem has been we've never been able to keep up with growth with the infrastructure of this state. It really is laughable. And they've always been behind in the growth. And you're right, there is a balance that can be struck. There is, if we had a serious growth management statute that was enforced, that was the whole idea, was to keep it manageable so that when you're going to build a subdivision, you don't create an instant water crisis. You don't create traffic problems. You don't have overcrowded schools. You don't have crime. But that isn't how it works. It's just amazing when you hear somebody like Scott say that the more growth there is, the lower the taxes. That has never been the case in any city in this country ever. Mm-hmm. The more population, the more people that are there, city or state, the higher the taxes. It never, ever fails because it costs so much more to support that level of population. The roads, the cops, the fire department, all of that costs money. So when you hear this naive boosterism, the idea that we need to keep feeding this engine of growth to save the economy. No, the cost to the average homeowner, forget it. He's the one who's going to pay for it.
Well, what sort of Florida do you see your grandchildren growing up in? I mean, you sound like you're a wee bit cynical about the future of the state. But
how can you not be? But I also think, just based on, and we talked a little bit about the just judging from these novels that I've written for kids, these four novels, which were all set in Florida, Hoot and Flush and Scat and Chomp. I mean, I get a ton of mail from kids all over the country, but also from Florida. But the letters are so smart and bright, and they have such a sort of innate affection for natural places and wildlife and the ocean and those things are so special to kids, and you get these letters, and you think there might be some hope, because that's face it, after you and I are gone, that's going to be who's running the show. Then it does help. It sort of keeps you going because you think, you know what, they care. These kids really help. I mean, when I was a kid, I never sat down and wrote a letter to a writer, to an author. It never would have occurred to me to do that. I get baskets of mail from these kids, and that's because I think they feel strongly enough, it's something they're much more aware of of what's going on in that part of their world than I was when I was 11 or 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of thinking about the way this was written, I mean, you've focused on the Keys here. Mm-hmm. A lot of your novels are sort of set around South Florida, and that's clearly pretty fertile ground for a novelist. Do you feel like certain parts of Florida are better to set your novels in? Or
it used to be because I worked, you know, I was at the Herald and I was in the newsroom every day in the old days. And, I mean, that was just my world, so it was natural to write about it when I started out. And I've since now get to do a lot of traveling, partly with the novels, too, you know, and just around. And, I mean, the other parts of the state have sort of caught up in terms of sheer weirdness and the freak factor. You know, I mean, there's great – I get clippings all the time from the Tampa St. Pete area, and the Panhandle is full of – there's some bizarre characters up there and Jacksonville as well. I mean, I think Florida is just ripe everywhere. And I think that's the reason a lot of writers have moved to Florida. I mean, novelists have not only come to Florida to write, but, Stephen King's down here a lot now. He's got a home on the West Coast. And there's a guy that it's hard to impress. But if you're weird enough where Stephen King wants to come, you got great material. And mm-hmm. It's pretty, you know, it has a supernatural element to it. Some of the headlines do. I used to think Miami had the market cornered, but I don't anymore.
How about Orlando?
You know, Orlando's got its own deal. It's, you know, I remember when it would be kind of pre-Disney or just when Disney got here. So my memories, young memories of Orlando are a little bit different. But, yeah, I mean, the stories that come out of sort of the theme park culture and Disney Universal and all that are so I mean, you have to. I mean, it's really like shooting fish in a barrel sometimes. The stories are so good. And it's not just the tourists, but, you know, I remember one time I had to do a story for the Herald back in the, I want to say, early 80s or something, when they just said, go up and see what kind of the lawsuits that are filed against Disney World. And you can imagine, and Florida's a very litigious state. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, 25 lawyers per square mile. And so these people would come visit Disney, and something fairly innocuous or silly would happen. And next thing you know, there'd be a lawsuit filed. So I went through these things, and it was just, there was so much great material. All you had to do was write about the complaint. I mean, it was just wonderful material. And I thought, man, this is just never, it's never going to end. Keep in mind, you have a place like Florida where 40 or 50 million people come here to visit. 40 to 50 million, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood every single year. I mean, that's like a whole country the size of France moving through your backyard every year. It's going to be great material. The material's always going to be there.
I've been speaking to Carl Hyerson. His most recent crime novel is called Bad Monkey. Thank you very much, Carl.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, a conversation with UCF Legal Studies lecturer and president of the Central Florida Gay and Lesbian Law Association, Chad Cronin, about the potential impact of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on marriage equality in Florida. Rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and California's same-sex marriage ban, Proposition 8, were hailed as major victories by gay rights advocates. To speak about these decisions and the impact they have on Florida, I'm joined in the studio now by Chad Cronin. Chad's a lecturer in the Department of Legal Studies at the University of Central Florida, and he's the current president of the Central Florida Gay and Lesbian Law Association. Chad, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
So I want to start with marriage equality. Now, two key issues were up against the court here, the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, and California's Proposition 8. First of all, the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on DOMA centered around the case of a New York widow, Edith Windsor, who was sent a $363,000 estate tax bill after the death of her wife, Thea Speier, in 2009. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the act was unconstitutional because it violated the right to liberty and equal protection of legally married same-sex couples, and the ruling struck down the part of the law which denied those couples from receiving tax and other federal benefits afforded to married heterosexual couples. So it clearly has a big impact on the gay community nationwide. What are the impacts or what are the implications, though, here in Florida? I mean, you have Governor Rick Scott saying it really has no effect on Florida, which he described as quite a traditional marriage state.
Well, Florida has its own Defense of Marriage Act. It has a state statute that also defines marriage as simply between a man and a woman. Federal law under the Supremacy Clause would trump that. This ruling will give teeth to advocates who want to see marriage equality move forward in the state of Florida.
And the actual effect of it, though, I mean, although you have people like Governor Scott saying that it isn't going to have an effect on Florida, you're saying, well, actually it will.
It absolutely will. It is absolutely going to lead to litigation in the 37 states that do not currently recognize gay and lesbian marriage. Mm-hmm. Because there's going to be 37 plaintiffs that are going to be bringing suit at some point to have their marriages recognized at some point. If somebody is married in New York and comes to Florida and Florida chooses not to recognize it, there is a very strong possibility that a lawsuit can be filed and that Florida's law will be challenged.
Let's move on now to talk about California's Proposition 8. It was a ban on same-sex marriage, and the Supreme Court, in this case, overturned the ban. So, I mean, the court was really looking at the constitutional standing of the law. They didn't really address marriage equality. Is this a disappointment for gay rights activists, do you think?
Oh, absolutely not, because when the court, basically said that they were not going to grant standing on this, that the petitioners did not have standing, they upheld the district court's ruling. And the district court's order basically found that the California voters in Proposition 8 and the Ninth Circuit's ruling against Proposition 8 now stands. So now people that live in the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit, by the way, is the largest federal circuit that we have. It governs almost the entire western part of the United States. Those entire states are now wide open for marriage equality.
Chad, I want to ask you now, will Proposition 8, will that ruling on Proposition 8 out in California affect Florida's Amendment 2, which was passed by voters here in 2008, and that banned civil unions or same-sex marriage?
I don't think that that case will affect Amendment 2, simply because this case dealt primarily with standing. So I think there will have to be a separate case that would have to go up the chain through federal court.
What about looking broadly at the state of Florida? How do you think these rulings might help or not strengthen gay rights in Central Florida?
In Central Florida specifically, I think that we are going to see movements in domestic partnership registries. I do think we're going to see the movement forward. We live in a community where there is a large gay and lesbian population. So I do think that the activism will move forward. These were great victories for the gay and lesbian community across the nation, but also here in Central Florida. This is something that has that gay and lesbian people have spent years and years and years working on.
I've been speaking with Chad Cronin. He's a lecturer in the Department of Legal Studies at the University of Central Florida. He's the current president of the Central Florida Gay and Lesbian Law Association. Chad, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.